Okay, people, it's around 10:59, and I need now to introduce you to John Simpson, who's going to tell you a few things before we get into our next session. Thanks, John.
Thank you, and thanks for coming back into the room so quickly. We're getting through the day, aren't we? And my thanks for your cooperation in moving between the workshops and so forth. Thanks, Bill. We haven't included a roll call because of the logistics of doing so. Okay, thank you. We apologise for that, but it's just not feasible to do it with so many people in the room. Okay, I said earlier that it's White Cane, International White Cane Day. BCA hasn't done much in this area for a while, but just let's go back a few years and listen to what Dale's got to play for us.
Hello, my name's Neville Kerr. You've probably seen me or another blind person using a white cane to travel around town. You know, my white cane's very important to me. It assists me to navigate through busy city streets. It helps me to find and manage various obstacles that are often in my path. And it helps me to locate important clues that assist me, such as these audible traffic signals. My cane also alerts other people to the fact that I'm blind and might occasionally need a little help. If you see me or another blind person using a white cane to get around, you might ask if I need any assistance. But remember, with my white cane, I can manage most things for myself.
Thanks, Dale, and thank you to our good friend Neville Kerr and to Bernadette Jolly for tapping the cane along the footpath as we recorded it. We had, in the days before portable equipment, we had cables out and all sorts of things up and down a footpath. An example of one of the things that we've done in the past as part of our community education program, something I think we need to get back involved with. That's all for me. Can I introduce to you the chair for this session, Dan Stubbs.
Morning, everybody. And we're nearly there. So the next hour, we're having a session which is... We've got a panel of people to talk about... getting and keeping a job, what works. I really wanted to bring a few people together with a variety of experiences in getting a job because it's an issue that I'm quite passionate about. It really upsets me to think about the high rate of unemployment in our community and the fact that we are, blind and vision impaired people are a very employable group of people, but we know that a lot of us do often have trouble getting work, and we've all experienced different forms of discrimination when either trying to get work or trying to advance in our careers and that kind of thing. So I am really proud to have worked with Matt Mirabella to bring together a panel of people with, like I say, a variety of experiences to share with you all, and I'm sure all of you have got things to share as well. So each of the panel members are going to just speak for around 5 minutes to give a bit of an overview of their experience, and then I wanted to maximise the time for all of you to ask questions or raise issues for the panel to respond to. The panel members we have are Crystal Malcolm, Bonnie Mosen, Mick Curran and Matt Mirabella. I'm going to start with Bonnie Mosen, who has been an employment consultant, a PR expert, and has written about being a blind person and getting a job. And of course, Bonnie is actually the hardworking part of the partnership, Mosen Consulting, too. So to kick off, please welcome Bonnie Mosen.
Thank you, Dan. I was a little nervous when I found out I had to go first, but want to welcome everyone here today for a subject that's very passionate to me. And I wanted to start out with a very brief story on the power of networking and how important it is, and how a lot of times with job search, it's not only what you know, but who you know. 8 years ago, this week actually, I found out I was being made redundant from a job I'd held for 10 years with an organization that I was passionate about. I was devastated. 2 days before that, I had found out that my guide dog of 4 years was having to be retired because she was losing her vision. Not only was I losing a loving partner, but I was also losing my livelihood. To say I was upset and angry is an understatement. But those emotions don't pay the rent in one of the highest rental markets in the country. So I stopped, gave myself a little time to grieve, had a few blue cocktails. I think a friend of mine had a few more than I did, and started to think, what can I do? The next day, survival mode kicked in. I worked for a guide dog organization, and a client of ours had called for some information. I happened to remember that she worked for a blindness agency in Massachusetts. That's in the United States, not rural Australia. And I remembered that she, or thought that she was a supervisor. I had a degree in vocational rehabilitation counseling, that's similar to your employment consultants, and asked, were they hiring? I explained the situation very diplomatically, did not let any anger or bad words cross my lips about my employers, and she said, at the moment, we're not hiring. I'll get your email. If we post something, I'll send it to you. That afternoon, they posted the job that I would interview for 3 days later and would ultimately be hired for. It felt really good to go into my boss and say, I have a job. That is the power of networking. If I hadn't have taken that risk and asked her, are they hiring, it would have been a much tougher road to have navigated. But I realized that I was part of the 70%, and I was also in an age bracket, a mature worker, where employers aren't as interested in. So I wanted to share that story about the power of networking. But also, I wanted to touch on a couple of other things that I believe are so important to the job hunt and job readiness. The title of today is Life Ready. How many of you in here are job ready? How many of you want to work? Or want to work better, harder, different job?
Say yes, people.
Say yes, people.
We know it's Sunday.
We know it's Sunday, yeah. That is very important. Motivation is extremely important. But it's not the only thing. To be job ready, you also have to be life ready. You may have all the qualifications, all the know-how in the world to go out and look for that job, but are you ready? And as blind people, sadly, we have to be even more ready than our sighted counterparts. It's unfair, it's not right, but it's reality. So I want you to stop and think when you're looking for work, what is your skill level? You don't have to be the best at O&M or the best at assistive technology, but do you have the skills that you could go in that day and actually start working? Have you thought about transportation to work? Are you able to navigate a public transportation system or call a cab, that sort of thing? Because these are what we call soft skills, and they're often more important to being successful in the workplace than the actual tangible or hard skills that we bring to the table. And a lot of times with the clients that I've worked for in the past, they've had all the motivation in the world, but they were nowhere as ready to go out and start employment as I would be to fly an airplane. Another thing I want to, because Dan's given me the signal for 1 minute, I can talk on this all day, is self-care for job search. It is hard, and it can be depressing, it can be demoralizing, and it can be humiliating, depending on how many interviews you go through. You have to take care of yourself. You're going to go through all kinds of emotions, and these are normal. If they become too troublesome for you to function, definitely seek help from a mental health professional. But also find support other places. Talk to other job seekers and learn that you're not alone. There's no shame in trying to find employment. And take care of yourself. Give your time to relax. Take time away from the job searching process because it is a job within itself. And I just want to conclude by saying good luck, and the right job is out there somewhere. And never, ever give up. And never underestimate looking for other opportunities such as self-employment or things like that, or retraining in a different career. Thanks.
Great. Bonnie, you might not even be aware of this, but you made the perfect segue to Mick Curran, Mr. Self-Employment. So many years ago,
Mick was a bit annoyed about the fact that, you know, getting a screen reading software is difficult and expensive and all that kind of thing. So what did he do? He made his own screen reading software, of course, like any of us would do. And then he made a not-for-profit business out of that. So Mick's had a whole different experience of getting a job and making it work. So, again, please make Mick Curran very welcome from NV Access.
Thank you, everybody. It's actually very nice, and it means a lot for me to be back here, actually, because I was quite active in BCA many years ago in my youth. Still pretty young, but, you know, but in my early 20s, and I was quite active. But I also had, I guess, sort of two major passions in my life, which were blindness advocacy, but also I really, really liked computer science and IT. And I was always looking for something that could merge those two passions together. And so I actually struggled a bit with university, balancing both sort of my interest in advocacy and, I was doing work in Young Blind Citizens Victoria and things like that, and also trying to do a computer science degree. In the end, I actually realised that uni wasn't really for me. I liked some of what I was learning, but just after having done school for, 12, 13, 14 years, it was just getting a bit boring, and I just felt that I wanted to get out there and make some kind of impact. I didn't really know what, and I knew it was also unconventional to just sort of, leave and, because I'd leave uni, I'd just be unemployed. But very quickly, I decided to try my hand at writing my own screen reading software because, frankly, I myself didn't really have the means to afford some of the commercial offerings, and I knew that there were others around who didn't either. And I was also very familiar with the free and open source movement and wanted to see whether we could apply that to assistive technologies. I also wanted to do a bit of an use it as a bit of an experiment to see whether not only, if I started this myself, would other blind and vision impaired people sort of come on board with this and have this as a bit of a project to make a bit of a difference in their own lives. I certainly know, the unemployment rate is, in Australia is what's, for blind people is, over 60%. And quite a lot of my friends, at least anyway, were blind, unemployed, but still had pretty good computing skills. And I couldn't quite, work out, well, then why aren't they just going into jobs in computing? And so I hoped, at least if they were going to sort of sit at home or whatever, that they would still be able to meaningfully contribute to something. And that's why when I did start the screen reading software MVDA, that I made sure it was open source and that people from the blindness community could contribute to it. And so I started that around 2006, and at the start it was really just a voluntary project, but very quickly it became apparent that this was meaning a lot to people around the world, especially in developing countries or non-English speaking countries. And so a lot of people in the community started coming on board, and we also needed to start looking at how to fund the project, because obviously I was simply just out of uni, unemployed, and I was just volunteering my time on the project. But I quickly decided that, if at all possible, why don't I try and make this my career? And that's definitely scary and hard to try and make your own business, and I had no idea where to start. But I think for me, it was just a bit of a journey. I didn't sort of throw myself in the deep end, straight away. I obviously had the blind pension and everything that was supporting me at the time, but I was also using that time that it gave me to good use. In 2007, a couple of friends and I, so including Matthew Mirabella here, my wife Amy Curran, used to be Amy Nee, my good friend and colleague Jamie Tay, started NV Access. which was a non-profit organisation around the MVDA screen reader so that we could get funding. But I've had to learn a lot over the last 11 years, I guess. You know, I've never technically been in the job market or anything. I really can't tell you anything about that. But what I have gained is, you know, how to start. We started by starting an incorporated association in Victoria, and that was a lot of reading and stuff on how to do that kind of thing. I've had to work with, you know, many international companies, Google, Microsoft, and all that kind of stuff, in terms of contract negotiations and accessibility consulting, all that kind of stuff. And it's been a massive journey. And I guess all I really want to get out of this is, you know, starting doing a small business isn't probably for everybody, but I just sort of think that it is an alternative that people can think about. If you have a dream or you think that you can achieve something, then just go out and try it. I really don't think you should just sit there and say, you know, no, that's impossible, I can't do that. Just start off slowly, you know, if you've got the capacity to do so. As I say, again, you know, if say you're single, you don't have any children, you're on the blind pension or whatever, you've got that little bit of support. It's hard, but you've still got some time to do stuff. Just try stuff out. You know, you might fail, it mightn't create a job, but in some cases it may, and it may go on to, you know, create your business and, yeah.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mick. Crystal Malcolm is the executive officer of Blind Citizens New South Wales. Prior to that, she's worked at PWD Australia, and prior to that, she's taught singing and has all sorts of other talents. Would you please welcome Crystal?
Thanks, Dan. Thank you, Bonnie and Mick. That was great to hear both of you speak. And it's nice to be on a panel with Mick. I haven't seen you over the weekend, but hello. I suppose none of us have really seen each other over the weekend. Anyway, it's great to have some old friends up here too. When Dan asked me to be on this panel, I was kind of thinking through the whole process of how I got my jobs and what that whole process was. And it's a little bit of reverse engineering because you've got to go sort of backwards and think, well, how did that happen? Sometimes I still think, how did that happen? But I started off, I guess, when Bonnie talked about having to develop these soft skills and that sort of stuff of, you know, good orientation and mobility skills and all that sort of thing, how to present yourself, knowing how to use your assistive technology, those type of things. When I finished high school, I took a year of just doing gigs because I was a musician. All I wanted to do was be a musician. I thought maybe one day I'd go to uni and do music therapy. That was pretty cool. And so all I really wanted to do was gig, make some money. I had the opportunity to record an album, and I'll talk a bit about networking because that's how that happened. So that was what I wanted to do. I just wanted to play music, get out there, make some money, and I had this grand idea that I was going to go and study at a college in England and, you know, become famous and all that. Life didn't quite work out that way, but that's all right. And I did end up getting together some money from the sales of my album to go to a private music college in Sydney. But that meant I had to move. My family decided to move up to Queensland, and I didn't really want to move up to Queensland with them. I wanted to stay and continue with my music. So all of a sudden, I had to half move out. I went and lived with my auntie and really had to work on, in that 12 months after finishing high school, promoting my album through the networks that I had and also doing the gigs. But then I had to, during the day, develop these skills. So I thought I'd just go and learn Central Railway Station in Sydney because that's where everything went from. So I figured if I knew how to get around there, I could at least get on a train to somewhere I didn't know and work the rest out at the other end. So that's what I did, spent some time doing that. My teaching I found out about through one of my other blind friends, Sam Taylor, who you know, while he was looking for jobs of his own, I guess, came across this little music school that had opened a couple of suburbs away from me, and he just told me about it. And I'm like, I don't want to be a singing teacher. I want to be an artist, you know. But I was also hungry because I didn't have much money. So I rang up about this teaching job and left a message and didn't hear anything. I went, oh, whatever, that's normal. And I didn't disclose. I actually had no idea about the interview process. I just rang up and said, yeah, I sing, and I just finished college, and yeah. And I got a call back, and a couple of months later, actually, and the guy said, well, you know, do you want to come in for an interview? And so I guess at that point I sort of thought, well, what are they going to ask me in this interview? This is about singing teaching. I haven't trained how to be a singing teacher, but I've had lots of lessons over the last 15 years, so I'll just go in and talk about what my teachers taught me. Doesn't matter that I've never done it. So that's what I did. Ended up getting that job, and I worked there for, in total, about 6 or 7 years. And I think at the busiest period, sort of for about 2 or 3 years, I had about 30 students a week. So then you get a whole bunch of other problems, because then I had to go and, you know, then I started to come across things I didn't know. So you put yourself out there for some professional development things. And it's been like that through all of my jobs. I haven't known totally what I was supposed to do when I get the job, but I've developed an ability to be able to find out how to learn what I don't know, I guess, or to surround myself with people who know more than me. That was what one of my mentors told me when I was doing lots of music. She's like, I don't have to know everything. I just have to have people around me that know the stuff I don't. So that's my take-home thing. If you don't know what you're doing, find someone that does and make friends with them. And so I guess, yeah, I've only got a few seconds left, but believe in yourself. You do know stuff. You might not know everything, but nobody does. That's the other tip. And there are people around you who do know, and just reach out, ask them, talk to them. Don't be afraid to say, I don't know. And just give it a go, like Mick said. If you've got something that you can start with, just run with that, and who knows where it'll end up. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Crystal. And the final panel member is Matt Mirabella. Matt now works in the law. He works in the Supreme Court, I think, as an associate. Matt has previously been working in IT in Telstra in the user experience area, and in the last recently had a bit of a career change to go into the law. And has, you know, some really interesting recent experience of doing that whole career change thing. Please welcome Matt.
Okay, we'll just move that a bit. There you go. That's all right. So, as Dan was saying, my experience, I sort of not really going to talk about so much career changes, some of the tips or things that seemed to work for me when I was trying to get work in my new career. Back in the dark ages in the 90s, I did a science degree at Monash, and then one of the first jobs I applied for I got at Telstra, and was there for more than 10 years, about 12, 13 years. In that time, I helped Mick start up NV Access, and I was involved in BCA in the early 2000s. And at that stage, when I got my job at Telstra, I just thought, well, you know, discrimination, I didn't really feel like I'd experienced it, and I sort of wasn't sure that it would happen, especially if you were really educated and you know, in your field. But since I've changed my view on that, I think discrimination is what happens, and it's, when it doesn't happen, that's the exception to the rule. In a sense, when I made my career change a few years ago and studied law to move into a different career, I won't go into why I did that, but it's not for this discussion necessarily, but when I did that, I experienced a lot more difficulty moving into the junior ranks of that profession, especially these days. It's just competitive across the board anyway. But I really do think that I suppose I've encountered three types of people in my sort of search for a place within the industry. and this could apply to any industries. I'm not just, law's just an example, but the first type of people are the people that will just assume that you're not capable and just won't even consider you at all and won't hear any sort of different view on that. And I reckon that's a sizable proportion of the population. Then the next group of people, let's call that A, and we'll call this one B, the type of people who would tend to exclude you, but if they knew more information, if they had a bit more information, if they had some certainty or some clarity on certain things, they would then include you just like everyone else. And then there's the group C, which are people who would include you anyway and don't really need much of an explanation. They're prepared to look at your CV and see how great you are. But that's a small group. A is the biggest group, B is the next biggest group, and C is the smallest group. And what I have found is that you can't do anything about the A's, but you can do a lot about the B's by bringing information with you to assist them in understanding what your capability is beyond just what's on paper in your CV. So what I want to talk about really are two things. First of all, the application process, and then second of all, the engagement in your industry. Well, the engagement piece is a bit like what Bonnie was talking about with networking. So the two things that I learned in my approach to the legal profession was when you're applying for roles within different, either whether it be law firms, government departments, courts, wherever, any mistake you make, any typo, any formatting problems that you make with any of your documentation, any sense in which it doesn't reflect on the job ad or the description, anything like that that you do legitimises the exclusion of you from the group of people that are actually applying for it. And then there's a legitimate reason for excluding you, even though the other reasons might not be ever admitted. Discrimination and so on might not be admitted. But if you can produce documentation that's clear, well-formatted, consistent, then that helps to curb any view that, well, you're blind, how do you deal with documents? How do you read and how do you actually create documents? If you can produce documents that have that consistency, whether it be CV, covering letter, whatever, selection criteria. So make sure that you do know how to do that and PDF them and send them as PDFs if you can and have someone look at them just to make sure that there's nothing about them that, where the formatting is really crappy. And that's not, you know, being less independent. That's using people you know and resources to assist. And get used to producing documents that sighted people are going to print out and look at. Don't assume that that's not going to happen. You're competing with other people that don't have vision impairment or difficulties. You've got to be able to present your documents in a good way. So make sure that you cover that off. Then when you get an interview, and there's another question about when do you disclose disability, I don't really want to talk about that much, but at some point you're going to get an interview, and if you do, you're going to be asked to come to an office. Reconnoitre, go to the place early, go there the weekend before even, and look around and see what it's like so that you can get there without asking for too much assistance. Some people will need assistance, but if you can be independent, as independent as you can be, the less likely people will assume that a lack of capability and a disability and a lack of independence all sort of go together. You'll be able to show that you're independent if you can get there without a lot of assistance. Now, I've just heard the bell go off, so I can talk a bit more about some of those tips. But I want to talk about engagement because it's kind of the more important thing. Engaging in the industry. I got a role in the Supreme Court of Victoria as an associate to a judge, and I'm now working as an associate to another judge, and I got a job next year in a government department, Commonwealth Government Department. So I finally got to where I needed to go. But part of that was because not just I put in good applications, but it was because I engaged as much as I could with people in the sector. I got mentors through mentoring programs and met other people who introduced me to other people, who introduced me to other people. That enabled me to get some what I call student placements or internships under my belt, which beefed up my CV a bit, but it also meant I had contacts. And when I applied to the courts to get these associate roles, I think I put in 30 applications and got one or two interviews. But the people that I put the applications into all knew who I was. And my relationship with them was something that I spent some time on developing, so that when a vacancy came up, I was one of those people they came to first, because I'd been engaging with them. And that's how I got into the roles I'm in at the moment. So engagement is, you know, it's not just about going around talking to people at cocktail functions or whatever. It's about just meeting people in the profession, so that then they don't think you come from Mars. Like I heard someone say yesterday, the view that blind people are sort of a bit different. If you meet people and you get along, they can see you're really just like them. And then you get introduced to other people, and then you become a known quantity rather than an unknown quantity. That's really all it is. And also it's persistence, of course. 30 applications, 2 interviews, eventually 1 job. Some people have an even tougher time than that, hundreds of applications. So persistence is another thing. I think those are the 3 things. I said 2 things. It was really the application process, the engagement in your industry, and it's also persistence.
Great. Thank you very much, Matt. I'm sure that's provoked a lot of questions and ideas and that kind of thing. Would you, if you have questions, or I'm particularly keen for questions, but short comments as well, put your hand up or stand up. When I first finished my degree many years ago, I spent around 12 months unemployed, and I wrote hundreds of applications back then. These days, I have the difficulty of being on the other side and receiving hundreds of applications for jobs. And one of the things I always tell people when they're going, I fully support what Matt was saying about applications, and make sure they're right, make sure they're on exactly the sort of message that the people are looking for. And when you get that interview, one of the things I've done myself, and I tell people to do, if you're getting an interview, contact 2 or 3 people that know something about that job and ask them, if you were interviewing for this job, what questions would you ask? And then just make a bit of a note against those sort of questions. Now, those exact questions won't come up, but it just gives you some ideas to start with. When questions like that come up, you've got something to start to talk about while your brain processes the question, and you know, you can provide some more specific sort of content for the answers to those questions. And it just allows you to have thought through the possible things that are going to be asked for you in that difficult interview process. That said, I know, you know, that there's a long way between being unemployed and actually getting that interview. Do we have some questions?
Yes. It's Michael James here, Dan.
Thanks, Michael.
I don't actually have questions, but if I can indulge people, I'd like to make a few of my own comments. I've spent 2 fairly considerable periods of unemployment over the last 3 or 4 years. And just a couple of observations, and I did count up the other day, and it was 200 and something applications I'd put in. So that's not meant to be a discouragement, it's a fact of life. So I would like to just speak about a few things. Firstly, I think applying for a job, I'm not going to say it's a full-time job, but it's a pretty significant part-time job. And I remember being about 3 or 4 months into the process at one stage and starting to get really discouraged. And I was talking to my sister. She said, how long have you been doing? I said, 4 months. Well, she said, you must be owed some leave by now. So I took 3 days off, and that was a really useful thing to do. It allowed me to sort of refocus, relax, and then get back into it. But unless you do it seriously and do go into your room where your computer is at 9 o'clock every morning and sit there for several hours and work on that every day, it's too hard. Disclosure. I think I've always been a big fan of you never ever disclose until you get to interview stage. You sell yourself, for want of a better term, first, and then you bring that up once you've sold your wares to them. Having said that, the last job I got where there were 150 applicants, 30 shortlisted, 10 interviewed and 3 employed, I had a gut feeling and went with it and disclosed in my application. So I'm not sure that proves anything other than there's no simple answer to do you or don't you disclose and when do you disclose. But I will preface it by saying I'm in a position where my mobility to get to job interviews and so forth is not a major issue for me. I understand that's a much bigger issue for a lot of people in the room.
One more, Michael.
Thank you, mate. The other thing I will say in terms of as a vision impaired people going for an interview, and I do use some adaptive technology, but minimal. I use screen enlargement and a keyboard and things, so it's not major. Whatever you do, tell them what you can bring to the job, not say, oh, I want your job, but you'll need to do this, 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 and this. Say, okay, I think I'm the best person for the job. From my experience, you can say I've done it, and I bring this to the position. So don't be needy or any more needy than you need to. Show them that you're in charge and it's not going to be a hassle for them to employ you because you're the best person and they don't want to miss out on you.
Thanks, Michael. Any comments on any of that from the panel?
Well, I agree completely with all of that. What an analogy comes to my mind is that a sighted person who's well-educated and qualified for a job, going for a job, maybe they're playing a game of lotto where they have to pick three numbers, and so that's a bit hard, but maybe that's not so hard. But when you've got a disability, when you've got discrimination that happens, when you've got all those other factors, it's like you've got to pick six numbers. And the odds of getting it is so much harder because you're compounded by the fact that it's just as competitive for you as it is for everyone else, but then on top of that, you're dealing with the discrimination. And I feel that the thing is to find ways to pare that back a bit, to bring those odds back. And what was just being discussed there does sound like one of the strategies. Another strategy is, at an interview, what I developed, and I didn't have this at the beginning, but I had it towards the end of my experiences with getting a job in the law, and that is to have a little document that I think the Americans call it disability impact statement, but I call it capability statement because I don't like the idea of disability impact statement. But what it is it's a document that explains this is how I do things, this is the technology I use to do them, this is what I achieve, these are the things I can do without assistance, these are the things I've done in the past, this is how I've done it. Because what happens at an interview is somehow it's disclosed that you have a disability somewhere either before that or at the interview, and there might not be much of a discussion that happens in that half an hour in relation to those issues, either because they don't want to talk about it or you're not in a position to talk about it. You bring it up, you might discuss it, but it's a very brief discussion. You don't want it to be too confronting, but you do want to leave them with something so they're not left with question marks in their heads over you. So having a document means that you leave it with them. It's only a two-pager in my case, and you leave it with them. You've explained a few things, but you leave that with them, and then they have something that either they freak out over, and if they do, then you were never going to get them anyway. Or if they're, as I said, the type B people who would be positive towards you if only they had more information, they're the ones that are going to have their minds changed by a document like that. Great. So having that with you and bringing that in, giving it to them, is another one of those things that brings you the odds back towards a little bit more parity with everyone else.
Great tip. Thanks, Matt. Bonnie, quick comment, then we'll go back to the floor for questions.
Great comments, Matt. That was kind of what I was going to say, but great bringing that up. Also just wanted to cover a little bit, just a tiny bit about disclosure you mentioned, Michael, and great comments from you as well. You could go around the room and ask everyone in here about disclosure. Everyone would have a different opinion, and none of them are right or wrong. A lot of it is what you feel comfortable doing. I advise people not to disclose unless it's in your favor. And what that means is if you are applying for a job with, say, Vision Australia, the Foundation for the Blind, any agency, disability agency, having that lived experience often is a bonus. But also you could look at it a different way. If you're applying for a position with, say, Vodafone or Telstra or some of the computer companies here, if you have assistive technology knowledge with web accessibility, you don't have to come out and say, gee, I'm blind. But you could say something about, I have experience using different screen readers or adaptive technology, and that could also maybe sweeten the pot a bit. So that's just kind of what I wanted to say on the disclosure Great. Matter.
Thanks, Bonnie. Who we got from the floor now?
Up here.
Stephen Jolly from Talking Tech with David Woodridge here. So my question is to Mick. When you were at uni, you were a tech geek. And you were well and truly into it. You got a bit disgruntled with the screen reader world, so you thought you'd do something about it. You decided to do something about it. But in doing that, you had to transition from being a tech geek to someone who had the skills to manage a business, be entrepreneurial, negotiate with third parties, maybe partners, such as hard-nosed Microsoft. I make this point because often people say, I'm pretty good at such and such, I might set up a business doing it. But that can be a particularly significant transition that they have to make. Can you tell us about that process?
Yeah, I mean, I think it happened very slowly. I mean, because what I was really doing was something just that I believed in, there was a need, and in some ways there was sort of no pressure for me to succeed at the start. So I was very lucky in that situation. As I said, I was, you know, for the first 2 years of doing this, I wasn't paid to do so. I was just on my pension or whatever, but, you know, I was enjoying what I was doing. And then it eventually, you know, eventually I got a small grant from Mozilla to do some extra work, and then eventually into full-time employment. But yeah, there's a lot of skills that you have to learn, and I think that I think it's about having the right support networks and things around you mostly. I mean, because I mean, first and foremost, if you want to learn stuff, just go out there and read books, or, you know, read documentation, listen to lectures, that kind of thing. There is plenty of information out there on how, you know, how to run businesses and stuff. It's hard, but you just gotta consume it. But also having the support networks. I'm slightly different, I guess, because I'm not going into another workforce where I'm just working for someone else. So, you know, the job interview process and stuff. Independence for me is a little bit different, in that because I'm running my own business, I can pull people around me to support me. So, for instance, when I go to Microsoft and things like that, I will take one of my sighted usually will take one of my partially or fully sighted employees with me. Now, I could do it alone, and I have in the past, but I find that I'm much better presented. I get to where I'm going quicker. Even though I'm the one doing all the talking, all the negotiating and things like that in general, I mean, he has his own duties as well, but the point is, though, that I don't need to worry about, you know, where the room is or things about whether I'm going to get dinner tonight or whatever, because, you know, whereas I can just focus purely on the business side of things. By the way, I'm still a tech geek, but, you know.
Another question from the floor. Who have we got?
Hi, this is Zell. I'd just like to make a recommendation to Blind Citizens Australia. Thank you. So Matt was talking about the odds. You know, so you've got odds of 3, 6. We talked about 6 having someone having a disability. And I wanted to expand on that to say that on top of that, in addition to having a disability, if you're from a culturally and linguistically diverse background, if you're from an Indigenous background, or if you have any other disadvantage, you've got even more odds against you. I actually lived in denial of that for many years, even though I was working to promote awareness of, you know, the triple or the discrimination. But, you know, it occurs. I've applied for jobs in the disability sector and didn't get it, and I've applied for jobs in other sectors and didn't get it. And nobody tells you the real reason why you didn't get it. So I think for Blind Citizens to actually, you know, really develop, I know you've started working on an Indigenous group, and that's great, but to also develop groups for KELD communities and maybe even LGBTIQ communities, I think it's really helpful, because the support that we can give each other in that sort of environment, those of us who are experiencing these things, can be quite vital, because you kind of find yourself having to deal with the issues around disability, and then the issues or the different concepts of disability from your own cultural communities, which are usually negative. And you don't actually, it's not so obvious to you going through it at the time what the problems are, but, you know, if you get a chance to discuss it with other people sharing similar experiences as yourself, it might actually make the issues more obvious to you and might help us sort of better position ourselves.
Yeah, it's a good point. When we're looking for work. And we forget, and you didn't even mention this, Zell, but also being a woman with a disability is also, you know, and I've done a bit of research in this area, that being a woman with disability, as well as being from a coloured background, provides, you know, intersectional forms of discrimination that, you know, we don't always think about. We're a bunch of whiteys up here, although, you know, Bonnie's a foreigner. Maybe you've experienced various forms of discrimination. Any comments from the panel?
It's Crystal. Hello. I guess, yeah, I totally agree with what Zell's saying. There's a whole bunch of different things, and even as we go through different life stages, like if we become a parent, or if we end up being a carer for somebody else in our family who maybe acquires a disability, or any of those sort of things. Plus, managing, I think it's really important, and this might be going a bit off what you were saying, off topic from what you were mentioning, Zell, but being realistic with ourselves, excuse me, about managing our own needs as a person with a disability. You know, don't go for a job that's, you know, 40 hours plus a week if you've got serious fatigue issues, or if travelling causes you a whole bunch of stress. Try and negotiate the hours, perhaps, or I don't know, have those conversations with people around you who can help you to really work out how that balance is going to work. Some of us have complex health issues or something, which might require us to need to take some time off sometimes, or to go to regular appointments with allied health or medical appointments and things like that. They're not necessarily things that you can talk about in the first interview, but it's stuff that's always on our mind. And so to have that peer support of each other, and specific areas where you can be free to talk about that sort of thing, I think is really important. So,
great. Thanks, Crystal. Who else? Who have we got next?
Hi, I'm Jessica. I'm working at the coalface of a rather large government scheme. What I'm curious about is actually keeping the job. So what I'm finding, and I found it previously with jobs, is that I get into a groove where I'm working extremely hard, feeling as though I'm not keeping up, and where the expectations are unclear, and I get worried that because of my disability, because I lack some of those soft skills you were talking about before, I'm not keeping up. And then I've had a very recent experience where my manager's been saying, you do 12 a week, that's what you have to do, 12 a week. And I wasn't managing 12 a week, I was managing 9. And a couple of weeks ago, we did our highest number as a team in a week. And it averaged out to, across the team, everyone had handed in 6.5.
Yeah.
During that week, and I'd suddenly went, so it's not my blindness, it's something else. And I'm just wondering, can anyone speak to that sort of feeling that, and I have heard of other blind people who are working very long hours, feeling like, you know, you have to just double your efforts.
Jess, if there's someone in the room that hasn't felt the imposter syndrome when they've been in a job, you can leave now. Because I imagine everyone's felt it. I've felt it. It's a classic syndrome. Some of us cover it up better than others. Who wants to go from the panel first on what Jess is raising? Then Matt's going to go first, and I'll
Turn to some others. Thanks, Dale. So that's interesting. When I was at Telstra, I was there for quite a while, and ultimately the reasons why I left weren't anything to do with me being pushed out or anything like that. The whole time I was in Telstra, I didn't find that happening so much. But what I did find was that it was difficult to know how to compare how I was feeling with the workload in relation to other people and the expectations that are on them. So sometimes you can be told the expectations are that you do 12 a week, and other people are told that as well, but they're not meeting those targets either. And maybe you're not meeting those targets, but you're not told that they're not either, because of course management don't want you to think that everyone's failing. They want you to think that everyone's doing great, so you feel like you're not. But they do that to everyone. They don't do that to just people with disabilities. The key to it is to have a good social working relationship with your peers, so you know each other and you know what you're doing. Obviously, if you've got some peers at work that are not very nice people, don't get along with them well, or they're you know, not the sort of people that you want to get along with. That's, you know, workplace politics is always something you've got to deal with, but there will always be some people in the workplace that are at your level or around your level, or even more junior than you, that you can work with, that you can talk to about how people are doing things and whether you can collaborate and help each other. And then you get to know whether or not you're underperforming, or whether it's like it's not just you, it's everyone. The other thing too is on this, is sometimes a little bit of geekiness, nerdiness, like what Mick was talking about before, and what I think I'm a little bit of a nerd as well. Although I don't write code the way that Mick and Jamie do, I have written computer code from time to time to solve problems that would take a week to solve in a few seconds or a few hours or whatever. That's not amenable to any job, like, you know, it depends on what you're doing, but there are some things that you can do, because a blind person using a screen reader like NVDA and using a computer, it's not about being a techie IT nerd, it's about just knowing those tools and knowing how to use those tools to help you. I never studied IT, but even people in my family who don't, in the extended family, say they think I'm an IT person. I was at Telstra doing product stuff, and I suppose it was a bit IT. I'm in the law now. NVAccess is IT, of course, but I'm not doing the work there. But everyone thinks I'm an IT nerd because I have computers around. The reality is they're just a tool, and I just learn how to use that tool because I know how powerful it makes you when you learn how to use that tool.
Very true.
It's not being an IT nerd necessarily, unless you really want to work in IT. But I can do things that sometimes mean I'm doing twice or three times as much as my other peers without knowing. Sometimes they're underperforming and I'm not, and I don't know that until I talk to them and until I find out what's going on. So there's a lot that you can do. And the final thing I want to say is, linking also to what Zell was saying, BCA, maybe other types of groups as well, but BCA in particular for blind people, having branches, having committees, gives young people, or anyone really, the opportunity to engage with a community at a committee sort of level and have that formal structure of a committee and have accountabilities and have minutes and have all of that stuff and learn how to work as a group. And that's what, I mean, well, look, when I started getting involved in BCA, I was already in Telstra and I'd done a couple of degrees. But even then, I still learned something about, you know, working on committees. And I know that Mick and Geordie and other people who I've met, in that was the first thing they ever did outside of school. And thanks for that. But that gave, I think, partly gave Mick, maybe, and Mick can talk about this. You know.
Yeah. Do you want to comment on that, Mick?
Just very briefly, yeah, I totally agree with Matt. I think, I was in, you know, Young Blind Citizens Victoria, National Policy Development Council, and Vic Coward, and those three positions, they definitely gave me a lot of, absolutely, heaps of skills in that kind of stuff. And yeah, maybe that is actually one of the answers to Stephen's original question, actually, a little while back, is, you know, where I got some of that from. And it is actually through BCA, and I'm very, very thankful for that I had that opportunity.
Bonnie, did you want to comment on the issues that Jess raised as well?
Just a little bit. First, I just want to say, Matt, if you ever want a career change, you would make a great VR counselor or employment consultant. I couldn't have said it better. I just want to touch a little bit on the retaining employment, because that often is a huge challenge for blind people. And honestly, for anyone that, when we've been in a job, we tend to get in a rut. We go there every day, we do our thing, whatever our thing is. But it's so important, as Matt and Mick both mentioned here, to continue your upskilling. whether it be something you can fix in the IT and you don't have to be a nerd, but also become an expert of something on your team if you work on a team. Make yourself a little bit indispensable if they cannot live without you. And also use those social networks within the office. Talk to your manager. Have frank discussions. Make them realize that I do care about my performance. I want to improve. And I think we all get in that situation where we're not wanting to learn new skills because we're busy with the old one. Who has time? And I'm guilty of it as well. I'll be the first to admit it. But be engaged at work. Even if you hate your job, be engaged at work and continue those professional developments, because it's a tough world out there, and sadly, persons with disabilities are often the first to be let go because of perceived low expectations, whether they exist or whether they're not. So stay engaged.
Mm, those social sides of being employed is very powerful.
Very important.
Crystal, do you want to add anything?
Sometimes we get a job that we can do most of, but there might be a couple of things that we just aren't sure how we're going to get around. Consider talking to colleagues and your management or whoever you need to about, well, hey, I'm really good at this, but I can't really manage this. So who on the team can pick that up and I will do something for them? As somebody who's had to write a couple of applications for people to apply for recently, you never know who's going to walk through the door and who you're going to interview. And there's people, it's nerve-wracking for us as well on the other side, interviewing and trying to find the right fit for the job. And we're open to suggestions of, well, hey, you know, I think this would be really great in this role, or, you know, things like that. We don't have, as a manager, I don't have all the answers. If a staff member or a volunteer or anyone I was working with came to me and said, look, I can do this really well, this person can do that really well, why don't I do this bit and she can do that bit or he can do that bit? I'd be like, great, fine, do that. You know, talk to people around you. Don't feel like your voice doesn't count and like the people who you may feel are more powerful than you in the organisation actually have more authority. We're all just people at the end of the day.
Great. Thanks, Crystal. I've got time for one more question.
Yeah. Oh. It's Debbie Cook here. I wasn't going to actually say this, but I will now, and then I'll lead into my next thing, so I'll just be quick. The points you were saying there, Crystal, I just want to say my last position, I tried all those things, what you're saying, but it didn't matter. It redundancy was treated as a first resort, so you know, I've done all that. So anyway, but what I've found now is I had some activity and I've started a business, Transcription Cook, I call it, and I think Braille will be part of what I want to offer. But it's much broader than that. It's transcription of audio recordings. I've had some work from Tokyo. I call myself founder and chief publishing officer. I have a website and I can have up to 100 emails addresses on it, and I've set up a website, and I feel to me that's replaced what I've lost, so that's really helped me. And actually I promote my blindness as good skills for having to be able to listen to recordings of varying qualities as an asset. And what I would love to do, my vision, and I need assistance to do it, but I believe it's achievable, and I've actually written about this in an assignment that I'm with my studies. I would love to have, and I believe this can be done, we source work and be a central transcription service. I would like to employ, and I really sincerely mean this, I would like to employ skilled, and I say skilled because you've got to have the skill to be transcribing audio recordings, podcasts, lectures, and go and promote ourselves, do all the lectures, because there are transcripts of lectures, uni lectures. And any uni that doesn't do it now, you say, well, there's a need for this because you can quickly find information. It's so valuable. So go and promote it, even if it's not being offered. Convince someone that they need it. And I'd love some help to achieve this. I would like to employ people to do it. I know the role so well, so I'd be able to have publishing offices. I'd love to build a company. So it can be done. I'm just one person at the moment. I'm a sole trader, but this is my vision. Thank you.
Thanks, Debbie. Time for just one quick comment from the panel, and then we're going to have to wrap up.
I think that's a great idea, and you know there are avenues for you to explore, particularly for people, you know, potentially people with disabilities like hearing impairment and stuff. They get the transcription of their lectures and other students as well if you can't attend. So good luck with that. I think it's great.
Matt, one final comment.
Look, I don't want to talk too long because I know Dan will ring the bell again on me. He's done that twice now. But what occurred to me just then was it doesn't have to be to do with blindness. You don't have to, I'm sure everyone knows this, but you don't have to, if you've got a business idea or a dream or an idea of something you want that's different than the way it is, or you just want to have something in your community that doesn't exist and you've got a business idea. It doesn't have to be to do with transcription, blindness, braille, screen readers. It can be anything. It could be a certain type of food, or you could even run a taxi business if you're not the driver. You could manage them. You know, like there's so many things out there that you don't, not only, you know, there's a tendency for people in BCA or just blind people to, especially when gathered together with each other, to think about blindness-related ideas for their businesses or for their ideas. But it doesn't have to be. It can be literally anything.
Ladies and gentlemen, there's a lot of other questions in the room. We've had a plethora of ideas coming up today about the whole experience of getting a job, keeping a job and what works. Everything from networking to find a job, networking when you're in that job in the workplace, learning new skills, people that have gone and got jobs, changed careers, created their own jobs. I think there's all sorts of other ideas. I really encourage you to talk to the panel members and each other about this stuff. We've heard today that we are in a community full of ideas and experiences which we really need to draw on. Would you please join me in thanking our fabulous panel members this morning? Thank you very much. Over to John Simpson.
And thank our chair, Dan Stubbs. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd ask you all just to give me your attention, and I include the 32 people who are listening to us on the internet, because I do have some sadder news that I'd like to share with you, and that is that we, of course, paid respect to Patricia Stillman last night for her work with BCA. Pat passed away this morning. So perhaps we could just take a few seconds to reflect on the life and the contribution of Pat Stillman. Thank you. We'll now ask our people at the front table if they could make room for the next panel. And Rick, I'm sure you've got plenty to tell us about.